It's Wednesday, October 28th, 2009, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org. And continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Good day, Stashers, and welcome to the podcast. We've got a lot of stuff to get to for today's podcast. Historic day in the state of California, where lawmakers there in the Public Safety Committee, headed by Tom Imiano, the assembly member from San Francisco, debated California AB 390, the assembly bill that would legalize the sales and production of marijuana in the Golden State. It's the first time that California has ever taken the issue up. There was plenty of live testimony that was covered on the web. A bunch of us from the Daily Audio Stash were in the chat room talking about it. And you can read all about that at the stash.normal.org. Just look for the Fresh Stash and you can click the link to get the whole stash and you can follow our comments on that. I've got some audio from that hearing today, some featured highlights that I want to bring to you. So let's get right to it. It only comes twice a day, but I don't care. It's 420 somewhere. Time now to take a look at our cannabis community calendar, which you can find at normal.org/calendar. Oberlin College Normal will be having their weekly meeting featuring Joel Musi, a graduate from 2004. He's with the biology department and he'll be giving a lecture on marijuana pain and inflammation, what you didn't know about endocannabinoids. He'll appear at the weekly meeting on Thursday night and then give the full demonstration on Friday morning at the Science Center. Check out Oberlin College Normal for more information. Also on Friday, Gory at the Quarry, the last festival of the year, takes place at Nelson Ledges Quarry Park in Ohio. Check out ohionormal.org for more info. Normal of Waco, Inc. is presenting an abnormal Halloween at Smoke and Rays on New Dallas Highway in Waco, Texas on Friday. Also on Friday, Tennessee Normal will be having their Halloween party at Carla's Place. Contact Tennessee Normal for more details. Saturday, October 31st, Halloween Day, Gory at the Quarry continues in Ohio, and New York City's Greenwich Village has their Halloween Parade. Check out Halloween-NYC.com for more information. And Normal Show Live will go on the air at 6 p.m. Pacific, giving you 2 hours of inside talk and fun from the Normal West Coast Media Headquarters Halloween Party. Should be a lot of fun. Madeline Martinez from Oregon Normal will be here, as well as others, to discuss the changes in cannabis law. Check it out at live.normal.org. On Sunday, November 1st, Lincoln Normal Nebraska will be having their meeting. Check that out in Lincoln, Nebraska at Coffee House Panache on Sunday. And on Monday, November 2nd, Kansas City Normal will be protesting at 4010 Pennsylvania Avenue in Kansas City to protest a new question number one, an anti-drug tax renewal. Check that out at kcnormal.org. And for more dates, times, and information on all of these events at the Cannabis Community Calendar, check out normal.org/calendar. And if you'd like to get your Normal Chapter's events on the calendar, send me an email at stash@normal.org.
It's a Normal shout out.
Today's shout-outs go to a couple of places that are just about to get brand new official normal chapters. First of all, to our listeners in Northern Virginia, I've got the contact information for the brand new Virginia Normal, and if you'd like to get involved on the ground floor, send me your contact information to stash@normal.org. Same thing goes to the folks in Beverly Hills, California. We're about ready to get started a brand new 90210 Normal, Beverly Hills Normal. And if you'd like to get involved, send me the email and I'll forward it on to the people that are getting that organized. Also, a general shout out to women. Normal is forming a new committee that will be part of women's outreach for Normal. And we'd like to hear from you what you'd like to hear from us. That is, how would you like Normal to be better representative of female marijuana consumers out there? We all know how the stiletto stoners phenomenon has shaken up the media world, and Republican moms for marijuana, like our own Jessica Corey, have also garnered a lot of headlines. We think women will be crucial to ending marijuana prohibition, just like they were crucial in ending alcohol prohibition. So ladies, send me an email at stash@normal.org and tell me what you'd like to see from Normal to better serve women in cannabis. Now, coming up on your daily audio stash, we begin with your hemp headlines, including excerpts from the California AB 390 legislative hearing featuring our own Dale Gehringer and an amazing performance from retired Judge Jim Gray. In news from New Hampshire, the legislature fails to override the veto of medical marijuana that was given by Governor John Lynch. And in Pittsburgh, firefighters agree to a new contract that stipulates random drug testing. We're continuing our best of music in the Daily Toker Tunes, and today we bring you some from the prolific Jet Baker and his song, I Like Pot, Don't We All? And of course, today is our cannabis science segment with Dr. Mitch Earlywine, and today we discuss a new study that compares the results of alcohol use, tobacco use, and cannabis use among pregnant mothers and the effects on their offspring. We also take a look at the drug testing of infants and how that affects women and what women can do about it. All that and more coming up on your Normal Daily Audio Stash.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 13 states today, and THCF has clinics in 8 of those states. Our doctors help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms such as in multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help you obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, California, Colorado, Hawaii, Nevada, Montana, and now Michigan. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our Normal Daily Audio Stash, Hemp Headlines. California debates legalization. Today was a historic day in the California Assembly as Tom Ammiano's bill, AB 390, was given a hearing today in the Public Safety Committee that Ammiano chairs. This is the bill to tax and regulate the sales and production of marijuana in the Golden State, and it marks the first time that the California legislature has ever taken up the issue of marijuana legalization. The hearing was live on the net today, streamed over California government's website, and I want to bring to you some audio from just one of the panels of people that came to speak, both in favor of and in opposition to AB 390. This is the chairman of the Public Safety Committee, Assemblyman Tom Ammiano, who drafted AB 390, introducing the members who will be testifying today.
Reverend Mary Moreno Richardson, Reverend of the St. Paul's Episcopal Cathedral, Jim Gray, retired judge, Orange County Superior Court, Dale Gehringer, Executive Director of California Normal, Scott Kirkland, Chair, California Police Chiefs Association's Task Force Rosalie Pakula, co-director of Drug Policy Research Center, RAND Corporation, and Ms. Simpson, again, from the Attorney General's Bureau of Narcotics Enforcement.
Reverend Richardson starts the testimony by explaining her past in working with abused women and documents a frightening, if anecdotal, statistic.
One of the stories I wanted to tell you that I used to facilitate the domestic violence classes for Santa Barbara County. And I would do a little survey of my own. This was a class of probably 15 persons, usually men, who had assaulted their partners. And I would ask them two questions. I would say, how many of you were under the influence of alcohol when you beat your partner? And out of 15 persons, at least 13 hands would go up. And then I would say, I have another question for you. I say, I want to know how many of you are under the influence of only marijuana when you beat your partner. And it was so amazing to see the responses. Most of them looked at me like I was crazy to even ask such a question. They even told me that. The question does not make sense. Why would I even get off the couch to hit my wife? So
would legalizing marijuana lead to less domestic abuse? Well, it's hard to say, but if people are going to trade alcohol for cannabis, it certainly seems likely. Reverend Richardson also goes on to explain how the current prohibition on cannabis is not keeping cannabis out of the hands of our kids.
So what I would like to, what I think we can improve with our marijuana, regulating marijuana, young people would have a harder time buying marijuana. Right now, it is easier for them to buy marijuana than alcohol or cigarettes because, as the judge always says, dealers do not ask for IDs. And I think it's really important on this issue that we need to think about our youth and protect our youth. Our youth are not protected right now. If I walk across to the park right now, I will not be offered, someone will not come up to me and see if they can sell marijuana to me. But if a 15-year-old goes across the street, they probably have a much better chance of being approached.
As I'm fond of pointing out, prohibition is not the control of marijuana. It's the abdication of any control over marijuana. We can't set rules as to how old someone has to be before they can purchase marijuana. Therefore, anybody of any age can currently purchase marijuana, and as Reverend Richardson points out, oftentimes easier than those of us who are adults. Reverend Richardson is followed up by Scott Kirkland, the chairman of the California Police Chiefs Association Task Force on the issue, as well as the police chief in El Cerrito, California.
People in responsible positions are voting on this issue, believing that marijuana is the same substance that they might have tried in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and the start of the 90s. If they did not try it, they knew someone who did and did not see the unintended consequences. But let us look at the plant itself. Marijuana is a plant that for centuries was unaltered. It grew in the wild. When the crude plant started to become popular in the 1960s, it was still considered wild. The plant was comprised of about 50% THC, the psychoactive ingredient, and 50% cannabinoids. The THC concentration was anywhere from 1 to 3%. With the popularization of the Canadian grow methods and the passage of the state initiative, the crude plant changed dramatically. No longer was the plant wild, but was grown in controlled environments. The crude plant was altered genetically, and a majority of the cannabinoids were eliminated. The plant today averages between 18 to 24% THC content. There have been plants that have been found to have THC concentrations in the low 30s. But the scientific research that is being conducted on the plant throughout the world is showing that the cannabinoids are the beneficial part of the plant, the part of the plant that has been bred out in terms of the current growing processes. The crude plant is now nothing more than a THC breeding machine.
Wow, so much reefer madness. Where to start? Well, let's start with the THC breeding machine that he speaks about. Yes, it is true that many of the cannabinoids in marijuana, the CBDs, CBGs, and so on, are very medically effective for things like pain and spasms and seizures. But we also find that the THC itself is also very medically helpful for nausea and for people that are suffering anxiety, depression, and other disorders. So it's not like the cannabinoids are helpful and the THC
THC is not, they're both very helpful. Number two, I'd point out that the reason why the plants have gotten more potent over time and the reason why they've bred for more THC and less CBD is precisely because of the black market in marijuana that demands a more potent product. If we have a situation where it's legalized, people could buy all sorts of varieties of marijuana and pick the ones that have more CBDs or more CBGs or CBNs compared to THC, and pick the strains that have lower percentages of THC if they wish. Now, this idea that somehow after the 90s, the marijuana turned into not your father's Woodstock weed, that's something we've gone over many times here. It's kind of interesting how he cites the marijuana of the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and the early 90s, as if people like him back in those days weren't raising that same fear. I remember it plain as day in the 80s when they started talking about the super weed that was so much worse than the 70s. I remember it plain as day in the 90s when they said, oh, now the weed is even worse than it was in the 80s. And they're using the same old song and dance here in the 2000s. First of all, his numbers are completely inaccurate. The federal government's own potency monitoring project at the University of Mississippi pegs the average of THC at around 10%. And that's when they're including samples of hash and hash oil. When you just count the domestic samples that are picked up in the United States, the average is around 8 to 9%. He talks about the averages being 1 to 3% back in the 60s. That's also not true. 1 to 3% marijuana is something we call industrial hemp. People were smoking good marijuana back then. They're smoking good marijuana now. Has it become more potent? Yes. The Potency Monitoring Project indicates a difference of about double, so maybe from about 4 or 5% to about 8 to 10%. Have there been strain Cs that have been in the low 30%? Yes, but they're very, very rare. The availability of high-potency marijuana has always existed, and it varies more from location to location and from month to month than it does over the span of decades. But regardless of all of that, potency is irrelevant when we're talking about marijuana. THC is a non-toxic molecule. It cannot harm you, so it doesn't matter how potent the THC is. More potent THC in your marijuana just means you use less marijuana to gain the desired effect. And since they're always complaining about smoking marijuana being the problem, if you're doing less smoking, isn't that a good thing? Furthermore, in the Netherlands, medical marijuana, if it doesn't reach 15% THC, they don't even consider selling it for medical use. And the United States government has approved Marinol, a pill that is 100% potent THC, and yet Mr. Kirkland seems to have no problems with that. Another thing you'll notice from Mr. Kirkland's testimony is the repeated use, 3 times, of the phrase crude plant in reference to marijuana. This is because they're getting outflanked on the medical issue. They realize that people know there's a medical use for marijuana. They're hoping to confuse you into thinking that the crude plant all by itself is somehow harmful, but that we could get benefits out of processing that crude plant into some sort of pill or spray or salve or something. It's kind of funny when they talk about the crude plant, and yet he goes on to talk about how it's been genetically modified into something different. Sounds to me it's not that crude if people are putting that much effort into genetically modifying it. But there's further reefer madness from Mr. Kirkland. This is another one that's been making the rounds of the prohibitionists. I think they get all their talking points on the same fax machine.
In 2005, the state of California spent $19.9 billion on substance abuse and addiction, or $545 per capita, based on a population of 36.5 million. Once again, I'm talking specifically about alcohol and tobacco. But the state of California collected $1.4 billion of tax revenue, or 38.69 per capita, on the sale of alcohol and tobacco products.
So the point Kirkland's trying to make here is that the money that is taken in on alcohol and tobacco taxes doesn't even begin to cover the cost to society from alcohol and tobacco use, which is a very compelling argument when you understand that alcohol and tobacco are toxic and addictive and can kill you. What that has to do with cannabis, which is non-toxic, non-addictive, and will not kill you, is still a mystery to me. In fact, if we start to think about the people who use cannabis, they probably have far less cost to society than anyone who uses alcohol or tobacco, again, because they won't die and cause many healthcare costs to be incurred. But if we consider that marijuana being legal might give people another choice, that instead of using alcohol or tobacco, they might use cannabis, we'd see even a further drop in the societal costs from all three drugs. It's not about adding a new vice. It's about giving people a smarter choice. If they can have the opportunity to make the smarter choice to use cannabis instead of alcohol or tobacco, it would be an overall benefit to our society.
A crime we are seeing an increase is drug driving. Even without marijuana legalization, this is a serious problem. A 2004 study of emergency room admissions for motor vehicle crashes revealed that more than half of the drivers admitted to a level one trauma center tested positive for drugs other than alcohol. This study, published in the Traffic Injury Review, was similar to numerous other studies. Significantly, when breakouts were done of the drugs that resulted in the driving under the influence accident and or arrest, the overwhelming majority of test samples showed marijuana in the blood system of the arrestee. Legalization of marijuana will only result in an increased use of marijuana, with a corresponding increase in drug driving arrests. Unlike many countries in Western Europe and over 12 states in the United States who provide that the presence of any level of illegal drug in a person's system is a driving violation, California has no statutory system in place to deter drug driving. In fact, I brought forward a bill that was sponsored by then-Assemblyperson Benoit to address this serious issue, and this committee rejected the legislation in 2008. Drug driving is a serious growing problem, and marijuana is a major element of drug driving. Law enforcement has no real tools to combat drug driving, and surely no one in this room could seriously suggest that legalization of marijuana will help with this problem.
First of all, Kirkland notes this supposed increase in the emergency rooms for people who are in auto accidents testing positive for marijuana. What he doesn't note is that the testing positive for marijuana is not at all causal to the accident itself. That is to say, there's no way of telling that the marijuana use is what caused the accident. Something else that has gone up quite a bit in that same period of time is marijuana use. So it's not surprising to see that we'd have more people testing positive for marijuana if they've been in wrecks, because there are more marijuana users out there, period. Again, it says nothing as to whether or not the marijuana actually caused the accident. But what I find most fascinating is the internal contradiction in Kirkland's testimony. Toward the end of his testimony, he talks about how law enforcement has no real tools, no way to deter people from using marijuana and driving. And so he suggests that what we need to do there is to have per se drugged driving statutes like they have in 12 states that say any amount of metabolite means that you're automatically guilty of drugged driving. Well, to me, I'm wondering, if you can't bust someone for their poor driving based on their poor driving alone, and that means you have no real way of telling whether or not someone was a marijuana using driver other than busting them for the marijuana or for the metabolites, doesn't that tell us that we've got a problem that's not really necessary to be solved? I mean, if you think about drunk drivers, regardless or not, if you take a breathalyzer of someone who's at a 0.25, their driving is going to be so poor that you could bust them for reckless driving anyway. My point being that if cannabis drivers are so hard to detect that you need special chemical tests to detect them, and you can't tell just off their driving alone, how much of a problem is it really? Now, Mr. Kirkland was followed up by Miss Fairchild. I didn't catch her first name, but she's with the California Narcotics Officers Association. And if that reefer madness didn't make you cringe, this will certainly do it.
If legalized, the cost of marijuana will no doubt decrease. Now, take a powerful substance, one that not only operates on but modifies the human brain by producing compelling effects, and ask how many more people will use it if it's very cheap, legal, and glamorized in the media. The answer is a lot. And what will this a lot bring us? Will it bring us lower violent crime? Maybe. If the crime committed by users seeking money to buy drugs and the dealers protecting their rights to sell drugs fall by amount greater than the increase in crime committed by dependent users who are no longer capable of holding a job.
Okay, so this is a debatable point here, that if we legalized marijuana, it would become really cheap and crime would go down because of the people not fighting over the expensive weed and the illegal turf. But would crime go down more than the associated costs and crime of marijuana smokers being able to smoke weed legally? Would they still be able to hold jobs? Newsflash, we are now. We're smoking weed now, we're holding down jobs now, and we're not costing you much now. It's not going to get much worse under legalization. And if you really think that the impact of someone smoking marijuana is as bad as the impact of prohibition and the violence it causes, then you're smoking something much stronger than I am.
According to SAMHSA, we have 14.6 million marijuana users now, with 4.2 million of them dependent on marijuana. What will that number increase to? And it will increase if marijuana is legalized. Remember that drug dependence is a chronic disability. After we create the drug-dependent population, we can't turn the clock back.
When she talks about marijuana dependence, I suppose she's talking about people who use marijuana frequently. The 4 million number is somewhere in SAMHSA about people that use more than 100 times per year, like me, who managed to hold down a job and pay taxes. But let's just give her the benefit of the doubt that marijuana usage would increase under a legalized system. The costs to society from marijuana users right now, a lot of that is determined by calculating the productivity of marijuana users based on their employment status. Well, all of us know, because of marijuana drug testing, the best full-time jobs are not available to us, and oftentimes we're underemployed by taking part-time jobs that won't drug test, and sometimes we're unemployed because of being fired from drug testing. So in a legalized marijuana world, I believe that even with increased use, there would be less cost to society as far as workplace productivity, because more of us would have jobs, and they'd be better jobs.
And I know what you think about violent crime. We picture it at robberies, guns, knives. But I'll tell you what, when a recreational drug user backs over your four-year-old, or some grief-stricken parent loses their teenager in a marijuana-related traffic fatality, they consider themselves victims of violent crime.
Oh, for hell's sake, the reefer madness of backing over the girl in your car, or the wreck from marijuana, please. If that's your rationale, then I'm interested to hear you explain how we're going to make alcohol illegal once again. Because I know plenty more people who have lost a child or a loved one thanks to a drunk driver than have ever lost a loved one or a child thanks to a marijuana-using driver. So please, explain to me how we're going to enact alcohol prohibition once again.
SAMHSA reported that ER episodes involving marijuana tripled from 40,000 in 1994 to 120,000 in 2002, and now surpasses ER admissions involving heroin.
Well, I've tackled that stat before, Ms. Fairchild, and let's give you a couple other stats that went up between 1994 and 2002. The past year use of marijuana went up by 50%. And the arrests for marijuana doubled in that time. So apparently what you're doing now isn't working. Isn't it time we tried something else?
Driving accidents in America involved marijuana killed more than 8,000 and maimed 500,000 every year. In July 26 of this year, Diane Schuler slaughtered 5 family members and 3 others while driving drunk and high on marijuana.
Ah, yes, the Diane Schuler case that so many prohibitionists brought up during this hearing. The woman who drove the wrong way and killed all the people in her car because she was drunk and high on pot. Drunk, as in a 0.19 blood alcohol content, and she had tested positive for something like 150 nanograms per milliliter of pot in her bloodstream, so certainly she had been smoking within the past hour or so. But let me reiterate, a 0.19 BAC, and yet I still haven't heard Ms. Fairchild talk about reinstating alcohol prohibition. Why is that? Next, we get Rosalie Pakula from the RAND Institute. She studies a lot of this drug law policy, and while not quite as reefer mad as the law enforcement representatives, she still has a few things to answer for.
I think it's very important to understand that prohibition, with whatever its costs, is extremely effective at keeping the price of marijuana very, very high. you right now have estimates of what would happen to the price in a legalized market, and the assumption in the revenue estimate was a 50% decline. If you allow the price to drop and tax it at an amount as proposed in the original legislation of $50 an ounce or some other amount to try to get the price back up to the artificially high number, you keep the incentive, the economic profit incentive for the black market to remain.
She actually makes a very good point there. If currently an ounce of weed costs, well, let's just say $300, and the government wants to throw a $50 tax on that, if a $350 taxed ounce is available and a $300 black market untaxed ounce is available, people are going to go for the $300 untaxed black market weed. The people selling legal weed will have to do something to make up the difference, either by offering more selection or better service or something like that, or the prices are going to have to come down. So let's say the legal marijuana seller drops his price to $200 an ounce, and then with the $50 tax on top of it, it's now $250 an ounce. Certainly people are going to go buy the legal $250 ounce compared to the illegal $300 an ounce. So then the illegal dealer has to drop his prices to below $250. Maybe he drops it to $225. Well, in that case, the legal provider has to drop his price again, and we have a bidding war going on between the legal suppliers and the illegal suppliers to the point where the marijuana will drop to the price of production plus the $50 tax. When it drops that far, the profit margins for the illegal dealers will be so low that they'll take up other businesses. There just won't be that much money to be made in weed. And even if the tax is too high and does help to support the black market, at least in a legal world, we can debate and change the amount of taxation that is applied to the product. Eventually, we'll get it figured out to where marijuana is cheap enough that it won't support a black market, but taxed enough that we can raise some revenues on it.
We have done studies looking at cigarettes, looking at the experiment that Canada did raising its taxes in the early 1990s, and a simple $2 difference in the price per pack of cigarettes between Canada and the U.S. created such enormous smuggling that Canada repealed its higher tax on tobacco. We're not talking about big price differences here. That was a simple $2 difference. So unless you legalize and let the price of marijuana fall close to its production cost with just a small tax, you will not get rid of the black market, and you now as a state will be forced to incur the cost of regulating the substance as well as fighting a black market. You'll have the dual problem.
Well, Rosalie, I'd be really impressed by those numbers on the Canadian smuggling and taxation of cigarettes if not for two factors. Number one, cigarettes are incredibly addictive. A cigarette smoker who does not have a pack of cigarettes and is in the throes of a nicky fit will do anything to get a pack of cigarettes. The same dynamic does not exist with cannabis. If we don't have some cannabis, we usually just do without until we can get some more cannabis. But also, when you talk about it being a small tax of just $2 per pack, we have to understand that cigarette smokers, especially those most addicted, are not just buying one pack of cigarettes. They're buying a carton, which contains 10 packs of cigarettes. So your little $2 tax is now a $20 tax. And this can be for people that are buying a carton a week or more. So talking about $20 a week over the span of a month is $80 worth of taxes that they're trying to avoid. But again, you do make the point that we're trying to make, that under a legal, taxed, and regulated market for cannabis, the price would have to come down and the tax would have to be reasonable in order to avoid and eliminate the black market. Now we get a couple of people to finish off for our side, starting with California Normal's Dale Gehringer.
Dale Gehringer for California Normal, the National Organization for Reform of Marijuana Laws. On behalf of Californians, millions of marijuana users who are tired of being created criminals and really would like to be law-abiding, tax-paying citizens. I would like to remind the committee of the failure of California's own marijuana laws when it comes to actually controlling use. That chart up there on the left of marijuana arrests shows from 1960, which is on the left, to 1975, that high point there, marijuana was a felony in California. That didn't prevent an explosion of marijuana use. which the legislature found was so expensive that they decriminalized. And we saw an immediate reduction in law enforcement costs as a result of that. And contrary to the prediction of opponents, it did not lead to California, quote, going to pot or any perceptible, actually, change in marijuana use in California. And there's a lot of studies that show no impact of tough marijuana enforcement on actual usage.
Dale's testimony is great and outlines many of the points that I've already made here in response to some of these reefer-mad prohibitionists. But to end up this segment on the California legalization hearing, I've got to present to you in its entirety the 5 minutes of testimony from retired Judge James P. Gray. He served on the Superior Court in Orange County, and when you need a cleanup hitter in a marijuana debate, you couldn't ask for anyone better than Judge Gray.
I guess I am the final presenter list formally on here, and I want to commend you, first of all, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hagman, for inquiring in this. I want to commend you for your leadership in bringing up this really important topic. And I'm also going to commend you for staying within schedule. That's an amazing accomplishment in itself. I would, now that I guess I am the last presenter, like to comment quickly about a few other things that have been discussed, and then I would like to talk to you about children. But that issue really has not been addressed particularly, except maybe by Reverend Richardson. The first is that if this state of California were to, in fact, make this marijuana no longer illegal for adults, that is not at all the same thing as condoning it. We don't condone the smoking of cigarettes or the using of alcohol, etc. So to put that label on it, I think, is inappropriate. Number two is I have an understanding that today, as we speak here in Sacramento, that there are thousands of people in prisons in the state of California today for doing nothing but smoking marijuana. Thousands in prison for doing nothing but smoking marijuana. Why? Because they're on parole for one reason or another. And once they get off parole for whatever that offense was, if they smoke marijuana, it's a violation of parole, and they're immediately put back into state prison with all of the benefits that they had accrued, getting jobs, etc., supporting their families, being lost. Another one is that the tougher we get with regard to marijuana prosecution, literally, from my experience as a judge, and I have seen this in Orange County forever, the softer we get with the prosecution of everything else. And that is something that we simply have so many resources, and if we're spending them in prosecutions of marijuana, we are not spending them for prosecutions of rape, homicide, etc. Then, marijuana will never put this violence that we heard earlier out of business. All of these statistics that you heard earlier about the violence and the killings of both the police officers and everyone else is occurring under today's system of marijuana prohibition, yes, etc. The only way you put these Mexican cartels out of business and these other violent creatures out of business is to undercut the price, to make it no longer illegal so that you don't have that enormous profit motive to get these people involved with that violence, etc. The only way you do it is to undercut the price, and Assembly Bill 390 is a really good place to start. Otherwise, there are marijuana today that is stronger in our society without a doubt. But the reason why it's out there and stronger is because of marijuana prohibition. That there are lots of people that would much prefer, like you said, not to use the stronger stuff, but the cardinal rule of prohibition is always push the stronger stuff. So if I'm a bootlegger and I run into the same criminal justice problems for selling a barrel of beer as a barrel of bourbon, guess which one I'm going to push? The bourbon, because I make more money. It's the same thing with marijuana. Nothing is going to be legalized in this state. It is a program of the strictly regulated distribution. It wouldn't be legalized. It's a strictly regulated distribution, just like alcohol and cigarettes. We hopefully will not advertise them. Please put into your legislation not to allow this to be advertised. We want to de-glamorize it, not glamorize it. So no advertising, and hold people accountable for their actions. I know I'm going on, but I'd like to talk about children for a couple of minutes, because today our marijuana laws are putting our children in harm's way. We are continuing with this failed program for all of its defects, so-called, because we want to reduce the exposure of a lifestyle of marijuana usage and marijuana selling to our children, and it's doing the opposite. Today, it is easier for our young people to get marijuana than it is alcohol. And if you don't want to listen to me, ask any teenagers you can find. They will tell you that because of alcohol prohibition, marijuana prohibition. And Reverend Richardson kind of stole one of my lines because it's true, because the illegal dealers do not ask for ID. So let's make it less available for children by regulating and controlling it. Number two, adult drug dealers will recruit children to sell drugs. They will recruit them into their own drug distribution system. For $50 in cash, you can buy all of the 15, 16-year-olds in the inner city or anywhere else that you want to. It's chump change for the adult drug dealer. It's lots of money for a kid. So you use them as gophers and lookouts and couriers, and as soon as their reliability is established, then they're trusted to sell small amounts of drugs out in the communities. And who do they sell to if they're out there doing it? I assure you, no one in this room. They're going to sell to their 14, 15, 16-year-old peers. That is despicable, and it's caused by drug prohibition. So I say, let's reverse that, let's turn it around, let's regulate it, let's control it, because this prohibition is not working. I believe it fervently. I'm so concerned about our children. I'm so concerned about this illegal marijuana out there with all of its ramifications. I want to reduce those harms by passing your legislation, and I commend you again for these hearings.
New Hampshire Senate fails to override Lynch veto of medical marijuana. From the Nashua Telegraph, Concord, New Hampshire. The state Senate bowed to the will of Governor John Lynch and blocked New Hampshire from becoming the 14th state to legalize possession of medical marijuana for chronically ill patients and their caregivers. After 3 months of private lobbying, no minds were changed in the Senate as today's 14-10 vote to override Lynch's veto of the bill came up two votes shy of the mandatory two-thirds majority. Hollis Democratic Senator Peggy Gilmore co-founded the state's first hospice for the terminally ill and pleaded for the bill's survival. Quote, "It's up to 16 of us in this chamber to look at those who are suffering to say, I understand and I will help," end quote, Gilmore said. The leader of New Hampshire's Coalition for Common Sense, Matt Simon, said he knew a few senators had told constituents they were capable of making the switch to backing the bill. Quote, "You never give up hope, so I'm disappointed. Now I'm not looking forward to making those difficult calls to people depending on the legislature to relieve their unrelenting pain," end quote, Simon said. Earlier today, the New Hampshire House of Representatives had, as expected, voted to override Lynch's July 9th veto. The 240-115 vote in the House had cleared the two-thirds majority bar needed to advocate a bill become law over a governor's veto. It marked the first time a legislative body took such a confrontational action since Lynch, a popular three-term Democrat, first became governor in January 2005. It's a shame that no minds could be changed in that 14-10 Senate. That's exactly the same number we got when the bill passed and went to Governor Lynch's desk. So 14-10, it just seems like 10 of those senators are adamantly opposed to protecting people who use medical marijuana. I guess they feel it's a good idea to lock up people with multiple sclerosis and cancer and AIDS and other conditions that could be helped by cannabis. It's a shame, but we will not give up. We'll be back and hopefully with a better bill to pass through the legislature. As far as Governor John Lynch, I can only encourage people in New Hampshire to call the governor's office, tell him what a mistake he made in vetoing medical marijuana, and to urge the Democrats in New Hampshire to run someone else against Governor Lynch, or maybe vote for someone else aside from the Democrat in New Hampshire. Who knows what could happen, but something needs to change to protect the folks in the Granite State. Pittsburgh firefighters okay random drug testing in new contract. From the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Pittsburgh firefighters soon will be randomly tested for drugs and can be fired for failing as part of the 5-year contract agreed to by city and union officials last week, Public Safety Director Mike Huss said Monday. Quote, "We still have the Labor Management Committee working out the details, but at a minimum, it will provide random testing for the first time," Huss said. They will immediately be terminated the next time there's a problem. End quote. Joe King, president of the fire union, said random testing is, quote, the prudent thing to do. People in this society hold us to a higher standard, and we agree, but it's very complicated, he said. Everybody's entitled to a second chance. End quote. State law says Pittsburgh firefighters can't be fired unless the action is approved by a trial board of three other firefighters, something Huss said the city has, quote, struggled with for a long time, end quote. The new process will set aside the trial board for drug offenses only, he said. Quote, there are some cases we've been very frustrated with. It's a small percentage, but we put a lot of trust in these folks, and we have to make sure they're clean and can function safely, end quote, Huss said. Let me get this straight. If Joe the drunk fireman, who shows up for work hungover on alcohol and regularly violates some safety protocols, let's say, then state law says that a board of three fellow firefighters must concur if the city wants to fire Joe. But if Bob the pothead fireman shows up for work completely sober every day and is an exemplary firefighter, only the positive result on a pee test is necessary if the city wants to fire Bob. Pittsburgh firefighters will work a 24-hour shift followed by 2 days off. If we want to make sure they're, quote, clean and can function safely, end quote, why do you have them working for 24 hours at a time? Certainly they get the opportunity to sleep in the firehouse between calls, but on a busy day, isn't it possible the firefighters wouldn't be functioning safely due to drowsiness? Furthermore, for the occasional user, especially a fit firefighter type with a high metabolism, most other drugs but cannabis will be undetectable after 24 to 48 hours. If Pittsburgh is really serious about making sure its firefighters can function safely, then it should employ simple, non-invasive electronic testing that detects all forms of impairment, regardless of source.
Well, I smoke some marijuana with some people I like, just like everybody does from the East Coast to the West. I didn't even notice the cop on the bike, didn't know I was about to be the 20 millionth marijuana arrest. Should have fought for marijuana law reform, should have gone to the web and typed in Norm. Norm to the L.org, normal drop the A.org, baby.
National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws.
The battle to end adult marijuana prohibition can sometimes seem endlessly frustrating and impossible to overcome. One way we bond as a community and draw strength to continue is by rejuvenating our spirit through art and music. The Marijuana Music Awards exist to recognize those sonic artists in all genres of music who feature a ganja-friendly message to motivate and inspire all the cannabis community. Our Daily Toker Tunes, brought to you by MarijuanaMusicAwards.com, feature the finest in blues, rock, jazz, hip-hop, rap, reggae, country, bluegrass, and dance music to enhance that 420 feeling while promoting the message of reform. To donate your song for possible use on the stash, enter it in the next Marijuana Music Awards contest today.
Continuing our look back at the best of the songs we've played on the stash over the past year and a half, while Tam from Marijuana Music Awards is busy getting ready for the 2010 Marijuana Music Awards. And today we get all lovey-dovey with Jet Baker, and he's about to release a new CD called Stoner Love Songs. Jet makes no secret that he likes pot, but today's musical hit puts it to verse with I Like Pot. Jet is a strong warrior for cannabis reform, and his wacky and fabulous comedy is his weapon of choice. Jet began his journey into marijuana music by winning a High Times contest where he won a trip to the Amsterdam Cannabis Cup in 2000. It was filmed for the first High Times reality show. He has been part of the crew at the Cannabis Cup ever since, hosting the Wake and Bake Amsterdam show each morning at the Cannabis Cup Expo. Since that historic event in 2000, Jet has become the most prolific marijuana musician in the world, with over 100 tracks about weed on iTunes. You can even find his music on Amazon and Walmart.com these days. Yes, Jet has done so much in the last 8 years to get out our message into the mainstream. As he puts it, cannabis is here to stay. Frickin' decriminalize it already. Hear, hear, Jet. You can interact with Jet on his website,
www.jetrap.com or just visit his MySpace page. And thanks for all the love songs. We feel the same way about you, Jet. It's Jet Baker with I Like Pot.
Hey, what's up? This is Jet Baker, and I like pot. But I love Normal. Normal is actually influencing changes in marijuana laws. Are you helping? This is my love song to you, Normal. It's from my new CD, Stoner Love Songs. And the only place on earth you can download it for free, legally, is normal.org. Hey, y'all. It's me again. Jet Baker here. Will you be my friend? I'll make the weed jams. Rockin' Amsterdam. In a pink and green and silver tiny microvan. Nice strut. Nice butt. Bust a nut, that's enough of that slut smut. To clear up all confusion, true, not illusion, true, not delusion, I have come to this conclusion. I like pot, I like it a lot. I like pot, I like it a lot. Puffin' on the KB, 420 is where you'll find me, cause I like pot. I like pot, I like it a lot. This would come as no surprise to those guys with red eyes and bliss bunnies worldwide. Tried and true, true and tried. It's jetrap.com if you're new. And all the Jet Baker tracks are on iTunes too. I hope you like my electronic supersonic sound. If you feel me, pass the joint and pass it round and round. Tell all of your friends where the music has been found. Share the love and pass the Jet Baker MP3s around. I like pot, I like it a lot. I like pot, I like it a lot. Puffin' on the KB, 420 is where you'll find me, cause I like pot. I like pot, I like it a lot. All around the world, boys and girls, they like pot too, just like you do. I bet money that you're faked right now. You're probably like, how did he know that? Wow, like I'm a mind reader or something like that. What? You're listening to a track called I Like Pot. So I figured you're baked now, right? Yeah, I'm smart like that. Plus, you're fully Greek, man. I like pot. I like it a lot. Now, how's everybody feeling? Woo! If you feel the same way I do and you know the words, join right in. I like pot. I like it a lot. I like pot, I like it a lot. Everybody. I like pot, I like it a lot. If you know the words, jump right in. I like pot, I like it a lot. Puffin' on the KB, 420 is where you'll find me, cause I like pot. Puffin' on the KB, 420 is where you'll find me, cause I like pot. I like pot, I like it a lot. I like pot, I like it a lot. So did you donate to Normal yet? They could really use your help. Love you, Normal.
It's tough talking to kids about marijuana, especially if you might be a parent who dabbled a time or two in your youth. So to help you out, get your copy of Dr. Mitch Earlywine's latest book, A Parent's Guide to Marijuana. Dr. Earlywine is an associate professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and an expert on the studies concerning marijuana, its effect on health and society, and the methodology behind the statistics. He is a frequent guest here on our daily audio stash. Dr. Earlywine lays it all out without the propaganda and scare tactics that parents know won't work with teenagers. He presents a rational understanding of cannabis, what it is and what it isn't, and why kids shouldn't be using marijuana. You can order today through Amazon.com or check our links at our blog, stash.normal.org. Who is telling you the truth about marijuana? The government? Scientists? Doctors? Which claims are scientifically valid and which claims are reefer madness? Every Wednesday, we separate the stems of propaganda from the buds of truth with Normal's look at cannabis science. Well, it's the middle of the week, and that means it's time for our regular dose of cannabis science with Dr. Mitch Earlywine from State University of New York at Albany. And Dr. Mitch, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much.
It looks like we've completed our summer festival season, and we made it through alive, so that's always good news. We've been looking at the most recent studies to come out. We're always looking at the most recent published papers and studies on marijuana and its use among people in society, and we got an interesting one that came through here, which was on maternal marijuana use, where they take a look at the substances that pregnant women use, alcohol, tobacco, or cannabis. And then they evaluate how that has affected their children over the long term. Give our listeners just a little bit of an explanation about how this study was conducted and what it discovered.
This is an astounding data set. We're talking about literally 6,000 plus participants who've been followed up longitudinally after their moms had reported on use of cannabis, alcohol, and tobacco during pregnancy. As you can imagine, this is a really controversial topic, and we don't want to, you know, suggest that drug use during pregnancy is a great idea or anything. Nevertheless, it was pretty clear that as far as predicting psychotic symptoms, which was something that cannabis has been blamed for in the past, clearly tobacco and alcohol are significant predictors under these circumstances, whereas cannabis is not. I have some, various caveats about this study, but the bottom line is this is clearly not the outrageous horror that we've often been led to believe. I'm not suggesting that pregnant women need to get high every day or anything like that. Nevertheless, if you did happen to get high before you found out you were pregnant, there's no need to worry that you're going to give birth to a footstool or even somebody who's going to develop schizophrenia later in life.
Hmm. And they were just focusing on mental issues, schizophrenia or psychosis. Did they take a look at any physical issues with the children of people who had smoked cannabis versus alcohol or tobacco?
I'm optimistic that they have gathered those data and are going to present them in another paper later this year, in part because they wanted to really stick to the focus of psychosis because there's so much rigmarole and chatter about cannabis and the psychotic disorders. As we've seen in the past, this really isn't a key issue unless you're using really heavily early in life. But you could see how they might want to check this out with maternal use during pregnancy because it would be an intriguing effect if it did pan out. I like that they were willing to look at tobacco and alcohol simultaneously. The fact that tobacco is predicting this is intriguing from a number of standpoints pharmacologically. If you do know anybody who's schizophrenic, often they smoke an incredible amount of cigarettes, and it's not just out of boredom. Apparently, there may be a certain susceptibility to some of those pharmacological properties. But also, women who drank basically, 21 drinks or more per week were also putting their kids at risk for this problem. And that was something that, we hadn't seen prior. Of course, everybody knows women shouldn't drink alcohol during pregnancy, but we didn't understand that this might be one of the many negative consequences that may stem from that.
So we've got plenty of research backing up maternal use of tobacco or alcohol causing physical problems. Of course, one that jumps to mind is fetal alcohol syndrome. Is this the first time they've actually looked at whether it would cause alcohol and tobacco would cause psychotic symptoms?
So with the tobacco, this is a relatively novel finding. The key thing with tobacco is generally lower birth weight. As you can imagine, here's a drug that decreases the size of the capillaries, so the amount of blood flow to your body is decreased, and of course the amount of blood flow to the fetus also drops, to the point where in some ways the fetal heart will actually stop if you're smoking tobacco during pregnancy, which is a pretty horrifying thought. And then that could, of course, impair cerebral development under those circumstances. Less blood to the brain, less oxygen. Of course, there's going to be less development. And that makes a lot of sense. We've seen other links of, literally adult tobacco use, or at least adolescent, and links to mental health, too. But obviously, that doesn't get as much play as the much smaller effects we've seen with cannabis. And this link to alcohol is also relatively novel. We usually see the stereotypical fetal alcohol syndrome things, looking for the drooping eyelids or lower IQ or things like that. But this is an actual, you know, mental health link that we haven't seen, except in the ADHD literature, where there may be some confounds, and that the women who drink 21 drinks per week during pregnancy also may be at higher risk for ADHD themselves.
Oh, I see. Okay. Now, you mentioned the common theme here of psychosis and schizophrenia with regard to marijuana use. And of course, this study was looking at the maternal use. How about the personal use? If someone using marijuana, we've talked about it before, but in case people are new to the show, they may still have heard those rumors that, you know, if you smoke marijuana, you'll go schizo, or you're more likely to go schizo, or something like that. What can we tell the folks that are worried about that?
And the bottom line on that is that, you know, a review of basically the 7 reasonably done longitudinal studies suggested that only in a really small subset of folks who are at elevated risk for psychosis for genetic reasons, and only if they use heavily early in life, do you actually see increases in psychotic symptoms. Now, folks who've already been diagnosed schizophrenic or with schizotypal personality or something like that, if they turn to it and use cannabis heavily, they are more likely to have a psychotic break. But in truth, the average person who starts in adulthood and who uses reasonably, there is no real opportunity to increase any psychotic symptoms under those circumstances. And I'm afraid this is actually an age-old cry. Literally in the late 1800s, in the country of India, you know, there was a hemp drugs commission to look at this, and they said this wasn't true either. It's funny how what's old is new again.
I guess so. Now, back to this study, of course, it was studying maternal use of alcohol, tobacco, and cannabis. And I wrote a post probably a year and a half ago about a young woman who had been busted because her baby, when it was born, they tested it, and it tested positive for marijuana metabolites. And so she got the book thrown at her as a, I don't remember if it was a child abuse charge or a neglect charge or something like that, with regard to, you know, putting her baby at risk because of her marijuana use. So based on these studies now that we're seeing that the maternal marijuana use may not cause that much harm, is there much basis for those kind of charges?
I think what, my opponents would say is this study is one study and they didn't look at really heavy use. And the number of users during pregnancy was actually relatively small. So they could argue that, there might be negative consequences that haven't been detected. Nevertheless, we look at these data, Mary Lynn Mothry's data, and a number of other studies. It's starting to suggest that at least, you know, if you happen to abuse, it's certainly not going to be a tragedy. We don't want to recommend the home game. Now, the idea that somebody could be prosecuted for child abuse or endangerment because of this is a really backwards notion, and I know at least 3 states have entertained this idea, but you can see how that's essentially going to turn women away from getting good prenatal care and good obstetric services during delivery for fear that they're going to be prosecuted under this. So then you end up with these horrible, you know, back alley births with people who really aren't qualified and who don't have the materials, the sterile kinds of things that you need in a good delivery. And this really just puts folks who might be at risk for problems at further risk. Mm-hmm. Instead, we said, look, come in. We're going to take good care of you. If you do happen to test positive, we're going to offer you treatment programs and let you live your life. What a surprise. People are more willing to come in. They'll get better prenatal care. The outcomes for the babies are going to be markedly better. And this works really well. Obviously, you know, we've learned this time and again, the carrot works better than the stick.
Yeah, and this is not a supposition by any means. There's an actual couple of comments on that post that I read where these women were saying, you know, I'm not going to go to the hospital. I'm going to have my baby at home. I'm going to have a midwife because they're terrified of the notion of their baby being taken away from them because they smoked a joint for morning sickness or for a headache or something.
Let's get into the details of this. How are they testing a baby to find out whether or not the mother had used cannabis, and what can she do as far as the timing or how long she should abstain to be able to have a safe birth?
I mean, in truth, if you just want a safe birth, this is not an issue, as these data and other data suggest. Obviously, daily use is not recommended. If you are using, in a battle against morning sickness and you're really having problems with that, talk to a physician, because they do have prescription drugs that are really, really good for this. Nevertheless, I understand folks who want to turn to cannabis under these circumstances. Data like these and others suggest it's not a giant, hassle, again, as long as it's not heavy use. Clearly, it's a hell of a lot better than alcohol or tobacco under these circumstances. The testing of basically afterbirth, I don't know how else to describe it, the testing of any of the tissues that come out during delivery is relatively straightforward and comparable to some of the blood tests we have for THC metabolites. And, because THC is fat-soluble and stays in the system so long, it really is detectable for a long period. If you have a midwife, I'm a big fan of midwives, and midwives do really well, and people seem to like the home delivery. And in general, they're less likely to, have this hardcore bust-em attitudes, and by all means go with that. Some insurance is kind of tricky with that, and if you're in a situation where you really do have to deliver in the hospital and that you're at risk for this, it's sad but true. You need to talk to a physician about this ahead of time, get a feel for their attitudes, and understand that it may be worth changing obstetricians midstream if you feel like this is going to be an issue.
So these testing methods that they use, you say they're somewhat like the blood testing methods. How long a period of detection would a mother have to worry about? She's delivering on month 9, so where would she have to stop?
In truth, it's depending on dosage and your own personal metabolism, but 3 months is not outrageous if you've been using regularly, and 1 month is pretty common as far as detectability just in, our standard urine screens and stuff like that. This is really a different setting where those are going to be comparable but not perfect predictors of how well you're going to do. And I just, I'm reluctant, given false positive rates and things like that, to give a number for fear that, I'll lead somebody astray. Mm-hmm. It's better to talk to who's going to deliver your baby and be candid about this issue and get a feel for, is his or her attitude consistent with your own.
Okay. I'll give a thumbnail recommendation of my own. I'll say don't smoke during pregnancy and definitely don't smoke during the last trimester.
And that's incredibly good advice.
Okay. Well, again, if anyone has any questions about this issue or any issues that have to do with marijuana health and society, you can send your questions to 420research@gmail.com. That's 420research@gmail.com. Every Wednesday we visit with Dr. Mitch Earlywine to answer your questions about marijuana and health, and we're glad to do it. Now, I understand you have a new book coming out pretty soon, so let me give you a chance to tell people about that how they can get their hands on a copy.
Oh, the substance abuse treatment book is now out, and it's on sale at Amazon. It's more for clinicians and folks who are in the mental health professions, but it's published by Hogriff, and it's part of the Advances in Psychotherapy series. If you do get a chance to take a look at it, I think you'll appreciate it. It's not your standard 12-step or abstinence-only approach. I really talk a lot of harm reduction. And if you've got a mental health professional you're working with on other issues and this has come up, by all means, grab a copy and give it to him or her. And I'm hoping a lot of folks in our field will get enlightened.
Yeah. And for those future moms that we've been talking to today, as your child grows up, you can get a copy of Pot and Parenting, The Parent's Guide to Marijuana.
Good point. That'd be a hoot.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Mitch. And we'll talk to you next week.
Sure thing, man. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, The Growing Truth About Cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.norml.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent.
Thanks for downloading the Daily Audio Stash. We leave you today with a reminder that tomorrow's Daily Audio Stash features the California Marijuana Report with Eric Brenner. And coming up this Saturday, of course, is Halloween. I'm having my second annual Normal West Coast Media Headquarters Halloween party, and we're broadcasting Normal Show live from the Halloween party, 6 to 8 Pacific time. So check that out. I'll have tons of pictures of all the people who show up. We're having kind of a costume party. We'll have the Halloween pictures up there on my Picasa web as soon as possible. If you've got Halloween pictures from interesting creative costumes for the year and would like them posted on the Stash, just send them to me at stash@normal.org. Thanks for downloading the podcast, and until next time, take care of each other, tokers.